Hello, and welcome to another episode of Dimes of Crime. This is your host, Haley.
And I'm Richa.
And yeah, welcome back. I am drinking a red blend from a wine company called Rabble. Rabble's label is really cool. I posted on my personal Instagram, but you like scan the label and it like comes to life. It's pretty cool. Nice. What about you? What are you drinking?
I am drinking a champagne. It's been a big long week. So yes, I am drinking champagne, but also it's been a big week for some big life decisions, which I know that you and I have talked about. So I'll leave it at that. So yeah, we opened a bottle 2 days ago, and champagne's hard to finish in one sitting. If you do with two people, then you're going to be lit the next day, which is not how I roll considering I have a full-time job and a toddler. And so yeah, this is the leftover of that champagne. Still good, still bubbly.
This is our second time recording this, first episode halfway through because my notes were resting on my computer and stopped the notes or stopped the recording. So yay for us. We're going to try to.
And it's a two-parter.
Yes. So, that's just going to lead us into what I'm going to talk about. A few things that I want you guys to know is one, this is going to be a two-parter. One will be released obviously today. And then the next will be next week. So if that absolutely...
No, one will be next week. Oh, because we're recording today.
Yeah. So if that absolutely irritates you and you need to listen to it all together, go ahead and skip this week and listen to it next week when they're both are released. We are going into Canada today. This is a case that is very well known. It is pretty much always suggested anytime I go on to any of my true crime forums or Reddit and I'm like, hey, I need women cases. This one always comes up. With that being said, this is the Ken and Barbie killers, Carla Homolka and Paul Bernardo. And yeah, so that leads me into the disclaimer. If you do know this case, you already know why the disclaimer needs to be applied. If you have never heard of it, there's pretty much everything you can possibly imagine involved in this crime. Minors, dismemberment, sexual assault, sodomizing, you name it, it's in there.
Cruelty against animals. Superfecta of everything true crime. So, it's not only just our first two-parter, but it's, I want to say, our first couples case, so...
Yeah, I think so. Where they don't kill each other.
Yeah.
With that being also the other thing, so that we did the disclaimer, we're going to Canada. There's a lot of small details if you really like to know all the details or you do know all the details. We're not going to be adding everything. For instance, if you do add everything, Stephanie Harlow did a three-parter, all an hour and a half. So I don't have the time for that. I ain't doing that. But if you want to listen to all the deep dives of this case and go down those rabbit holes, go listen to her YouTube. It's pretty good.
Honestly, the gist of this case is still pretty gruesome. So the deep dive is just depressing. Still interesting, but just depressing. So,
right. If you really like true crime because you like the psychology and why people do things like that, this is a very interesting case for that reason, I guess.
Obviously, our sources will be listed.
Anyways, let's talk about the case now. We all have certain deal breakers that would instantly end a relationship with our partner or stop us from getting to know a new person any closer. For some, they include things like having children, different values, substance abuse, problems, and unfaithfulness. It is safe to say that most of us would make an immediate 180 and run away if we found out the person we are dating is a violent criminal. But not for Carla Homolka. When she met the man of her dreams back in 1987, absolutely nothing was a deal breaker for her. Not even the fact that she knew very well her new boyfriend's hobbies including assaulting women. Let's get into the first part of the Ken and Barbie killers. Carla Leanne Homolka was born on May 4th, 1970 in Port Credit, Ontario, Canada. Her father, Carl, was a Czechoslovakian immigrant. Sorry if I said that word wrong. I have a hard time with that one. Traveling salesman and apparently an alcoholic who often fought with his wife, born and raised Canadian and a
geriatric.
Can you say that word for me? Thank you. Geriatric clinic worker, Dorothy Seeger. Now, it's been said that Carl absolutely adored his firstborn daughter and doted on little Carla. But at the same time, she and her younger sisters, Lori and Tammy, were also targets for insults during their father's drunken episodes. Fortunately, Carl understood to often retreat to the basement to sober up or simply wait for things to calm down after an argument. But nevertheless, the situation at the Homolka household was not exactly ideal, even though those close to the family later said they seemed to get along just fine. Which is not really anything new, of course. Many dysfunctional families are very skilled in hiding what is going on behind closed doors. The thing is, in certain circles, it is very well known that Carl Homolka also had a wandering eye. He was literally earned the nickname pervert at his wife's working place because he always tried to get the woman to sleep with him. But you know what Dorothy did when she found out. She approached her colleague, a woman named Linda, who was in the middle of a divorce when Carl casually told her he was in love with her and said, and I quote, "You could save my marriage if you sleep with both of us," end quote.
Interesting approach.
Right. So, suggesting the threesome was Dorothy's reaction to his husband, to her husband playing around. As you can guess, Linda politely declined and left. And life went on as if nothing had happened. I literally pictured that
conversation. I'm like, listen, Linda. Listen. Listen, Linda.
I know. I have a hard time anytime I hear Linda or the name Karen to not, like, put those two things together.
Which, I'm so sorry if your name is Linda and Karen, but I mean.
Connor calls me Linda all the time. Drives me nuts, but. I'm sorry. Plugging my computer in here. And making sure that I'm still recording, because I don't want to. Yeah. We're still recording. We're good. So let's get back to Carla. On top of having to comfort her younger sibling when their father had a bit too much to drink, Carla also struggled with some health issues. She was reportedly severely asthmatic and had to be hospitalized frequently, especially after situations when she got excited or frightened. But other than that, Carla was literally perfect. Imagine a girl with long blonde hair, wide eyes, a gorgeous smile, and a bright mind. Basically me. Okay? Me. Just kidding.
Duh. I don't know, minus the homicidal and other tendencies.
Really. Just talking about looks here, okay? But we both talked about, we don't really think Carla Homolka is that pretty, but whatever, especially now.
Yeah, and I was saying that it just has to do with now that I know of Carla Homolka because of what she did. And so that by itself makes a person ugly to me.
Yeah, for sure.
I don't think a person's attractiveness is defined by just their looks.
Right.
I think there's a lot that goes
and the
into
photos
it.
Posted, I feel like, of them at that time are always like mugshots and bad pictures. You know, like when as you're a victim, you get the pretty photos, but you don't deserve those photos when you're a criminal. Just saying.
You don't deserve any photos when you're the criminal.
Yeah. Yeah. According to Carla's family, she learned to talk and walk early and was already reading as a little girl. In grade school, Carla scored 131 on an IQ test, which translates to someone who is very gifted. So to put it in perspective, only 2.1% of the world population is part of the IQ range, which is really crazy. What we talked about earlier, our first time recording this is, you know, a lot of times you think criminals are dumb because they get caught. Serial killers tend to have pretty high IQs for some reason, but whatever.
Well, that's why they go undetected for so long, I guess.
Yeah. But despite all the test scores and her teacher describing Carla as eager and enthusiastic, a good student, she mostly got average grades and did not exactly always get along with her peers or adults. While Dorothy only described her daughter with positive words such as smart, sweet, active, fun-loving, outgoing, a leader, and an instigator who always surrounded by friends and academically and socially successful, there was the other side of Carla. You see, she was also quite a domineering and stubborn person who had a difficult time compromising with those around her. Carla always needed to have her way. In addition, from a young age, Carla did not hesitate to talk back to adults and rebel against authority. But it was nothing compared to what was about to come. And there was this incident where basically Carla was playing with her friends and stuff. And this is kind of just like how Carla was. But like, if she wanted to play a game, she would play the game. If she wanted to like play with that Barbie doll, she would play with that Barbie doll. And so I think if it wasn't a serial killer that we're talking about, we would be like, that's a boss bitch. But because it's Carla Homolka, she's just a bitch.
Yeah. And, you know, like, there is definitely hobbies, like, just because we're in to true crime and, you know, researching murder stories doesn't mean we're going to go to kill people. And so there are certain, I don't think hobbies or interests, especially at a young age where you're impressionable, are correlated to what you do in the future.
Right.
What is correlated is, you know, your environment, your upbringing, your nourishment that you were provided in terms of love and care. All of that plays a huge part into it. And I'm not just saying that parents or lack of parenting is the only thing that makes someone a serial killer. But, you know, it obviously plays a part into it.
Right. And with that being said, we are going to be talking about Carla and the things that she is interested in right now. And again, like we were saying, we don't think that makes you a bad person to be into those things. But in this case, it's going to play a part. So around the time, Carla began to attend Sir Winston Churchill Secondary School. She became somewhat depressed, and by high school, she had changed her style completely. Carla started to wear black and dye her hair different colors every other day, in addition to wearing heavy dark eye makeup. And according to her friend Amanda, Carla often talked about things like screaming tunnels and spirits and burned candles and incense all the time. And Carla wasn't the only one dressing like this. Carla started trends. She was a trendsetter. People liked Carla. She was popular. So she shows up in black.
Literally just pictured Mean Girls, where she cuts holes into her shirt and then everyone.
Exactly. That was what I'm putting down what Carla did. She dressed black. Next day, the girl's wearing black. So.
Yeah.
But another classmate, Lona, also said that at the time she noticed Carla had strange marks on her arms. And this is something the other girls will not be doing. The teenager was cutting herself and apparently carving circles into her skin and then filling them with nail polish. Ouch. Like an open cut and nail polish sounds freaking miserable.
This is a really gross story, but I used to play indoor soccer like ages ago. What feels like ages ago, and because of wearing cleats, really tight cleats on my feet, my nail fell off, like my big toenail, and I didn't even know that it was injured. I literally just was showering one day and it fell off because that's how dead it was, and my big toe looked absolutely gross. I'm pretty sure I have a picture of it somewhere on my Facebook and I posted and everyone was like, oh, gross. Well, to hide the fact that I didn't have a nail on there, I used to paint it.
I was going to say, did you paint it? Did it hurt?
It didn't hurt. I mean, honestly, when it fell off, everything, the wound under it, it had
like cauterized, yeah, or whatever.
It had healed, yeah. The nail bed was uneven for years, like if months, if not years. It took a while for it to grow back normally, but yeah, I used to paint it for the longest time.
Yikes. And ouch, but ouch losing it. It's weird how nails do that too, and they get all bumpy.
Yeah.
During her time in high school, Carla basically did whatever she wanted, whenever she wanted, with whomever she wanted. Nobody could tell her what she could or could not do. Carla later admitted she experimented with drugs and had sex with a boy named Doug, whom she dated at the time. This man would later say that Carla was absolutely consumed by the thought of death, but somehow he only saw it as interesting feature, apparently. Doug did not care much, even though Carla threatened suicide constantly, and I feel like I'm really fascinated with death, but not like suicide, but like, you know, what happens after you die, or we do a true crime podcast and we like true crime and nope. I'm consumed myself and that kind of stuff. So
all the nopes. I am not fascinated with death at all. I do not want to know. I'm afraid of growing old. I'm going to be that old person that does not grow old gracefully. I'm going to fight it like every step of the way.
Right. Like, I don't want to like watch somebody die or see dead bodies, but like, I want to know, like, what happens when I die. I don't want to die in pain, you know, those kind of things. And I think about death a lot. But I think normalizing death is good because we're all going to die, so.
This is like words and or my nervous laughter, which seems an inappropriate nervous reaction laugh to what Haley is talking about. But yeah, I absolutely have no fascination with death. I do not think that we should normalize death. I don't want to be desensitized to death. I want to be... I think there is such a thing as a healthy fear of death.
I mean, I think that way about sharks because I'm scared of dying by a shark, but I don't feel that way because... We gotta freaking come to terms with that we're gonna die.
There goes my buzz like the Buddhist for tonight.
Anyways, I know I'm already out of wine, so I gotta refill. But we'll do that in the second part. Now I lost my part place.
Death.
So yeah. So around this time, Carla also told stories to her girlfriends about sadistic orgies with bondage and hard spanking. Nobody knew at the time, but these fantasies would play a major role in later events. Again, don't think you're a bad person if you're into bondage, as long as it's consensual.
Yeah, I'm not, to be clear, I'm not barfing at anyone's fetishes here or what their interests or kinks are. I'm just barfing at her crimes, if that wasn't clear.
Yeah, just say I like to be spanked, okay? I
know we've gone through this before, and mom and dad, actually dad texted me today that he was listening to our Killer Clown episode, so they do listen.
God. Yeah, when you know your parents are listening, they'll play the whole
different
part. Parents,
in-laws, that's an so during her- different level.
Maybe they're listening to that one because that one's in Bay, Florida. So during her high school years, Carla had been working a part-time job at a pet store. And after graduating in 1988, she was hired by Thorlado Veterinarian Clinic as a full-time veterinarian technician. By that time, Carla had already met someone very special during a trip for work to a veterinarian convention in Toronto. And Carla loved animals. That's what everybody said growing up, that she loved animals, and that's why she wanted to be a vet tech. Richard like knows the story I'm about to tell, and it's not funny. But Carla took, so she was at her friend's house. Her friend had a hamster, and she convinced her friend to make a parachute for the hamster and throw it out the window. Sad to say, the parachute did not work.
But if it helps you, the hamster it did died not die immediately. We recorded this one more time before this, and Haley told me that as she was going to give me some relief from this awful, awful story. She was like, well, you know, it didn't die immediately. And I'm like, no kidding.
I didn't say that I was going to give you relief. You just took it as there was going to be relief because I said, but anyways. Whew. Okay. This funny. This story is not funny at all. I'm just telling you. You're going to cry at the end, I promise. In October 1987, 17-year-old Carla Homolka laid her eyes on a handsome young man wearing a nice windbreaker, a blue button-down shirt and dark cotton pants. At a hotel restaurant in Scarborough, that man was 23-year-old Paul Bernardo. And we can't talk about Carla without talking about Paul, which leads me into the very question that I already said. But this will be for you guys the first time. And we're not going to talk about it right now because you really have to get to two parts. But think about it while we talk about this. Would Carla do these crimes if it was not for Paul? And is Carla part of victim? Or did they just bring out each other's dark sides and it was bound to happen eventually? So ask yourselves those questions as
asked
we continue
and answered.
On.
I shall give my opinion later.
Richard already knows the story, so she already has her opinion. So of course, I mean, so do I. So Paul was born on August 27th, 1964 in Scarborough at the youngest of three children of Kenneth and Marilyn Bernardo. Just like Carla's parents had their issues, so did Paul's, but in a way, way more disturbing way. Apparently, the only reason the two had married in the first place was because Paul's maternal grandfather, who had not cared about Marilyn's wishes regarding her future husband and basically forced the two together. And as you can guess, forced marriage is not really? A happy marriage.
No kidding.
And I know, like, in India, it's... Well, I know India has... I was scared to say that because there's a lot of arranged marriages. Well, I should say, there, but
arranged marriages don't necessarily equate to forced marriages. Yeah.
Mean there forced, is,
you right. know, other practices, yeah. and there are times when they're forced because there's that concept of dowry and, you know, there's just a lot more other layers to it. But yeah, I will say arranged marriages don't necessarily mean forced. It just, I look at arranged marriages like the old time, the older generation's eHarmony, you know, instead of having a dating site, your parents were the dating apps. They just talked to each other and exchange notes on whether they had boys or girls. And if this is what they were looking for, that's how I look at it.
I feel like that's a good way to look at it, though, for sure. And I mean, it obviously works for some people, and I think you can really choose to be happy with someone. But I mean, in this case, Marilyn was very upfront about not wanting to marry this man and was basically forced to do it. So Marilyn, and this is Canada in the 80s, so I mean, probably back then the 60s or whatever.
What's really funny is because you brought up the forced marriage / arranged marriage thing, I used to think that... This is such a stupid fear, but it just how used to happen. You know, when I used to think about arranged marriage and love marriage, I used to think, you know, if you're in a marriage that's not arranged, clearly that was by choice and you knew each other prior to that. So what if when you get married, you run out of things to talk about? Like all of your like courtship's done. Whereas in an arranged marriage, there really is like a honeymoon phase. Now, it's completely possible that the risk is that you get to know the person and you don't like them, which is huge. And I would never take it. And I didn't.
Right.
But my parents were in arranged marriage and they're doing great. I just sometimes always have this fear, like, you know, what if at some point Drew and I run out of things to talk to each other about? But then you have a toddler and you're like, you know what he shoved in his mouth today?
I mean, I feel like I've run out of things to talk about and I'm just like, so there's dishes in the sink. I was like, God. Your kid gave me hell today. So he headbutted me and gave me a black eye. He bit me and gave me a welt. True story, by the way. So, yeah. Back into the story before we get too far into that. But I was scared to bring that up because of I knew your parents were arranged marriage.
Yeah.
But it's good that we had that conversation, I feel like. As you can guess, forced marriage is not a happy marriage. So Marilyn suffered from depression to some degree and would often just disappear from the family home and leave Paul, his sister Debbie, and brother David unattended. Oof. Meanwhile, Kenneth would, amongst other things, molest Debbie. He would face charges for peeping and pedophilia later in his life, as he should. But somehow, Paul was not that much affected by the horrors happening all around him and was described as a happy child. Even though he did create a habit of setting fires where he was not supposed to during this time of the Boy Scouts, which undeniably sounds a bit worrying. So by the age of 10, Paul had grown up to be a very proud young man who loved himself very, very much. He had overcome struggles caused by tongue tie.
I loved your polite way of describing someone that was like completely self-absorbed.
Right. He literally could not speak for several years. That's how bad his tongue tie was. But when he finally could, Paul quickly learned how to use his newfound talent. Eventually, he became a silver-tongued devil who did not charm young women by just his looks, but by basically talking the pants off of most of them. Some of Paul's actions...
I'm sorry. It's late. I'm tired. Everything's just... has like a funny side to it, and probably I'm nervous, so the giggles are not because I'm laughing at something Haley said or that's funny in the case. It's just
it's Richa.
If you've been listening to us for a while, this is just it's me
nervous
and if
laughter
you care about it and are offended by it, then
we're not the podcast because it's probably gonna keep
care.
happening.
I honestly just don't care.
Some of Paul's actions were definitely questionable already, but at the same time, he was living the life of a handsome and socially talented teenager. Paul Bernardo was a very happy man back then. But of course, things did not stay like that forever. In 1981, when Paul was 16 years old, everything changed. One day, Marilyn suddenly stormed into her son's bedroom and threw a photograph of a man on his bed, saying that Paul was not Ken Bernardo's son. She added that, in reality, Paul was a bastard, and he might as well get used to it. Way to go wrecking your child's identity like that. So Paul looked at the picture.
Heck, that is a really weird thing to do.
And this is like one of those things that we talked about. It's like parents really play a role, and it's these little incidences. I mean, it's not a little incident, but just like that one thing that you might have done drunk or in a rage has played an effect on his whole life. You know what I mean? Not saying that.
You know, I obviously am not. His mom was clearly not in a happy marriage or like a situation. Right. And so I understand she had issues of her own. But I still can't imagine.
And not doing saying that to like, I mean, kid. You could do it in a different way. Like, hey, like that creepy old guy that I have to marry is not actually your father.
Yeah, you know, Uncle Tom is really your dad, Tom. Like, that's go about it.
And not saying that she's responsible for him being a serial killer, but just like, as parents, it's hard because, I mean, today, for instance, Crew is screaming in the car on the way to the doctor's and on the way back. I'm like, just shut up. Just stop. And I know that makes me sound like a bad parent. And I'm not saying I'm perfect, but God. And then you feel bad about it because you're like, all it did was make him yell at me more. But it's like, I'm literally losing my mind. I'm sitting there like, freaking stop. Just stop. And like playing the music louder. Like, there's nothing I can do. I'm driving. And then he plays this game where he goes, owie, owie, owie. I'm like, nothing hurts.
Yeah.
Nothing hurts. You're fine. You're in a car seat.
Oh, Leo's in that phase where everything's a boo-boo. And it's cute slash sometimes it's just like he'll drop water on it. So like, boo-boo. Boo-boo.
I know. And it's like, cute because, okay, you know, I'll eventually they're not going to want you to kiss their boo-boos. But.
I know. They're going to be like, Mom, I don't want your kisses. And I'm going to be like, girl, you're going to get them, okay, whether you like
them or not. So Paul looked at the picture and immediately knew his mother was telling the truth. This guy, who had once been Marilyn's favorite suitor, looked exactly like him. In Paul's head, all the nasty things Kenneth had ever said to Marilyn now made sense. Repulsed, Paul, too, began to call his mother whore and slut. In turn, Marilyn called him the bastard from hell. Other than that, Paul did not really Paul did not really show how much finding out the truth about his father affected him. Shortly after, Paul's first girlfriend, Nadine Bramer, left him for one of his friends after finding Paul's behavior too controlling. This time, the young man collected all things Nadine had given him during their relationship and burned them. The hatred towards women began to grow deep inside Paul's mind, which I don't think burning stuff from an ex is not that weird, but what's about to happen is very weird.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think he needed the girlfriend for that. I think his
mom called him. And him being controlling is a pretty red flag, too.
Good enough reason to hate women. Probably comes from thinking that relationships end up like his parents. But I'm not just justifying it, but like I'm the trying psychology. To figure out, that's what I like. I like to figure out how someone forms their ideologies. And
definitely, and so probably part. So after high school, Paul went to study at the University of Toronto and developed a habit of seducing young women he met in bars. But just having sex was no longer enough for Paul. Now he wanted to humiliate them and hurt them. And day by day, Paul's fantasies became darker and more disturbing. One of these fantasies included a so-called virgin farm. And yes, it's exactly as bad and disgusting as it sounds. Paul literally wanted to build a farm to breed virgin girls for him to abuse sexually. How someone can even come up with an idea like that is beyond me. After hearing that delightful detail, it definitely does not surprise anyone to learn what Paul Bernardo did next. Starting in May of 1987, at least 19 young women between the ages 15 and 21 were horribly attacked in the suburb of Scarborough in Ontario. All of them, excluding a few that were fortunately able to fight their attacker off, were brutally raped, beaten, verbally abused, and threatened so that they would not go to the police. For 5 years, five long years, the so-called Scarborough rapists kept the women of the area in constant fear. During that time, Paul Bernardo was interviewed by the police twice, actually, and yet he was never officially named a suspect.
Let me guess, way too charming. Too pretty to do any of this.
Right. Right. So you tell me that despite a mountain of physical evidence and over a dozen victims who had literally seen Paul's face and were able to describe him to the police to some degree, they were not able to put two and two together. not even after talking with him not once, but twice. For reasons unknown, the composite sketch that was made based on these poor women's descriptions was not shown to the public for more than 2 years. So you may have noticed Paul began his raping spree in May of 1987 and went on for nearly 5 years. But didn't Paul meet Carla in October 1987? Yes, he did. And Carla was very, very well aware of Paul's dark side. Yeah. There had been an immediate attraction between the two from the second they saw each other at the hotel restaurant. From that moment, Paul and Carla were inseparable. The two quickly learned that they shared the same dark and twisted fantasies and began a sadomasochist relationship.
Yeah, but look Carla at that alone, word.
I know. I was like, I gotta say this one slow. Another one, I was like, the way it spells does not seem like how it sounds. Okay. But Carla alone was not enough to satisfy Paul's needs. And so, with his girlfriend's knowledge and approval, he continued to rape other women. Eventually, the two got engaged, Carla telling her friends how, and I quote, "Paul and I are happier than ever. He's being so great, so romantic, that's typical of my honey," end quote. Blech. Different people can have very different views of what it is romantic gesture, but assaulting young woman is definitely not usually on
the
list.
There's a difference between romantic and illegal for sure.
Right. And now comes the problem. No matter how happy Carla thought her relationship with Paul was, he always needed more. One specific thing Paul was not happy about was the fact that Carla had not been a virgin when they met. And for that reason, he was apparently allowed to look for that experience elsewhere. And so in 19...
I do not like where this is going because I know exactly where this is going.
And so in 1990, Paul became obsessed with a young, beautiful girl he knew very well to be a virgin. That girl was Carla's 15-year-old sister, Tammy. And that is all for today. We have gone through the backstories of Carla Homolka and Paul Bernardo, but we have only barely touched on the horrible crimes these two committed together. In part two, we will talk about those three women who did not escape from the hands of the Ken and Barbie killers alive.
Heavy, heavy, heavy cliffhanger.
And listen next week. With a drink in hand, a big strong one, because next week's
just get
more gnarly.
Bottle, you know, a mini bottle of wine next to you. It doesn't have to be a full bottle. If you want a full bottle, that's fine too, but a mini bottle for sure. All right, don't let the murder dodge bite.